Welcome to part two of our series about refugee health. In part one, we talked with Dr. Allison Henderson about global and refugee health, given her international work and her experience running the Refugee Resettlement Clinic with her team in London, Ontario. You don't need to listen to part one to understand this episode, but the background and context is very informative, so check it out if you can. This episode will focus on addressing healthcare workers and medical students in general, as Dr. Henderson provides practical advice and tips for those interacting with refugee populations in the healthcare system. So, Dr. Henderson, given that you work at the Refugee Resettlement Clinic, I really want to know, why should more healthcare providers consider taking on refugees as patients? I know we've touched a little bit on the complexity of care, so I think it'd be really useful for the listeners as current and future healthcare providers to know why they should even consider to take on refugees as patients.
So my first reason would be because it's so fun. So I think this kind of goes back to my personal journey a little bit, but when I was first in med school and had that sort of like, I want to save the world and, you know, be with MSF and, you know, all those things that we all think, I've sort of learned along the way that I need to really enjoy what I do and I need to have fun or else I don't have staying power. And I've seen that in my colleagues too. And so for me, working with refugees is really interesting because I see pathologies and presentations and infectious diseases that I wouldn't see as often in sort of your more like regular bread and butter family practice. I also really enjoy the learning. So whenever we have, you know, a family coming from a culture or a region that I don't know anything about, it's like this whole new adventure. So, you know, hopefully I've maybe done some reading, like I've had a bit of, you know, a tip off that we're starting to receive some of these patients and I've done a little bit of background reading. But then it's also this, you know, process that you go through to learn as you're interacting with this family or this patient about what their cultural norms are, what a headache means to them, what psychological distress might present as, what their goals are, what they think being healthy is. And so you're sort of adding to your worldview and expanding your own wisdom and your own knowledge as you go. And I don't think we get that opportunity in all fields of medicine to continue to grow on such a personal level. And you're sort of forced to do that with refugees or else you can't understand or meet them where they're at. And so you're continually learning things about how to be resilient yourself and your own family and your own children. And I'm, you know, we're talking through parenting issues and I'm like, oh, okay. Like I'm also thinking about what they're telling me and thinking about how I can apply that to my own family. And then it keeps you grounded, I think, in a way. We live in a world that's so connected. And, you know, an example is I was driving to work last summer and they were talking about how it was the 2-year anniversary of the Taliban taking over Afghanistan. And they were talking about the lack of access to education and healthcare for women and girls. And I felt really overwhelmed. Like I felt like there's nothing I can do about this. I can't make any impact on this type of situation. And we're hearing things like that all the time, right? Like Ukraine and Syria and Palestine and, you know, all of these ongoing situations. And you just feel shattered sometimes and you feel helpless. And then also sometimes you feel guilty. Like I'm here and I'm fine and my kids are going to school and they want to know if they can, you know, have a play date tonight. That's their biggest concern. And I got to work that day after listening to that on CBC. And my first patient was a man who had just arrived from Afghanistan and he had an ingrown toenail. It wasn't a big deal. You know, it was just an ingrown toenail, but he was in pain and it was red and it hurt. And I removed it, like the section of the toenail that was giving him pain. And he was so relieved. And I felt good because I was like, you know what? I can't fix the Taliban situation, but this man has just arrived from Afghanistan fleeing the Taliban because he was an interpreter and I've just made him have less pain. And so I think you start out, at least for me, and I just want to be a helper, kind of what Amina was saying, I want to be that savior. And then you start realizing as you mature how much you gain from these experiences and how much, you know, what you do, you want it to also be something that feeds you and gives you joy. And I see that in these refugee families. And just like Amina said too, Ebola, we see these families and these some of these individuals go on to be really successful, to then be employed in our clinic or employed at CCLC. And it gives you that hope, I think, that, you know, as much as the world is a mess, we see that there's a chance, right? And that keeps you fulfilled and helps you to keep going in a way that then I think you're able to also support your team and your patients. So that would be like the selfish reason for why I think you should have refugees in your practice. And then also, I just think that like this is the modern makeup of our society. So even London, right, has now become a much more multicultural city. And I think there's some, you know, prediction that, you know, well, in Toronto, at least it's 50% people are foreign born who are living in Toronto. And so that will become true in our city at some point too. And of that proportion, a significant amount will be refugees. And so this is the reality. This is our Canadian makeup of society and culture. And if you're resistant to that, then to be honest, you're just behind the times. And so this is going to be part of your practice wherever you are, whether you're doing eMERGE, whether you're doing GenSurg, whether you're doing internal medicine, you are going to need to have skills to have cross-cultural humility, to go into an encounter and not be like, I'm cross-culturally competent. You're going to go into the encounter and say, I don't know about your culture. I don't know about what diseases mean to you. Tell me about it. Like, I don't know if they still talk at Western about fifing a patient.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah. So, you know, we always roll our eyes and make fun about it at skits, right? At tachycardia and things like that. Mm-hmm. But in refugee medicine, it's so useful because you're getting that connection that Bola's saying, where you meet them where you're at, where they're at, and you're understanding what disease means to them. And it's also opening up your Western paradigm, right? Like, we're trained in a Western system. The whole world is not Western, and we don't have the, you know, we don't know everything. Our system doesn't get everything right. And so this gives you a window into other systems that you can learn from. And I think it makes you a better provider.
For sure. So how can current and future physicians practice more inclusively to address the needs of refugees? I know we spoke previously about how not every refugee is the same. Different populations have different experiences, but as some more basic rules, how can people practice more inclusively?
Yeah, so I think it's going in open and also going in knowing that you might not accomplish a ton at the first visit. That the first visit might be about making sure that the patient feels safe and making sure that they have the opportunity to speak and to be heard. And kind of what Bola was saying too, recognizing what their priorities are. So even if you're, let's say you're in an eMERGE and they've come in and you just really want them to take this blood pressure medicine because their blood pressure is really high, but what they're talking about is their headache and how they can't sleep because they're stressed about, you know, maybe it's back to that patient, the family member who's been in the earthquake in Turkey. If you can't draw that line together for them about how, you know, their hypertension might be part of the cause of their headache, they're not going to get buy-in. And so you're going to need to really address the whole person and the whole situation. In primary care, at least, I think a big part of it is letting the patient know that you're going to see them again. So oftentimes, like when I was working in Zambia, we didn't necessarily have primary care in the way that you would see the patient again in 4 weeks or 8 weeks. Like, there was just so much acuity or lack of resources that you were always sort of just putting out fires. And so you weren't necessarily able to follow patients up well. So that happens to refugees when they're living in other countries, especially when they're displaced and they're maybe not able to access the actual healthcare system that they're in, or they have to pay money. And so when they get in front of you and are sitting in front of a nurse practitioner or a physician, they think this is their one chance and they got to get all of their issues out. And sometimes, not always, but sometimes it's like medical issues for 20 years, right? And that can become very overwhelming as the provider. And so sometimes you can almost shut down or like try to put the brakes on the patient. And what they feel is they don't want to hear from me. They don't realize that it's actually your own internal distress that's happening there. And so I find sometimes a really good statement is to say, I know we're not going to get to everything today and that I'm just getting to know you, but I'm going to see you again in 4 weeks and we're going to talk about this, this, and this. And then I'll usually ask the patient, you know, somewhere in that opening part of the conversation, tell me what the most important issue is to you today and then tell me the other issues, just in case one of the other issues is like angina, right? That they haven't identified as the most important, but I want to make sure we get to, mm-hmm. so that it's sort of this negotiation where like they've picked this one that's really important to them that might be their back pain for 20 years that I know I'm not going to fix, right? Maybe ever, but probably not today. Mm-hmm. And I've also gotten to talk about their angina because that's in my mind, what's like most likely to cause them morbidity and mortality soon, right? So sometimes it's a bit of that negotiation. And then another thing too would be to practice inclusive care is I don't always separate families right away. So we're kind of taught like, you know, make sure you talk to the woman on her own in case there's domestic violence going on and that type of thing. And I think you want to be paying attention to signals and clues. Maybe you will need to do that the first time, but a lot of times families are very afraid of being separated, right? And so maybe too, you have a male head of household who's very nervous about what kind of conversations you might be having with children or teenagers. And it actually is probably more inclusive to see them all together the first time and help them all to feel comfortable and help them to all have trust. And I've always found that after you do that the next time, there's no problem when you want to see people on their own because they're like, oh, I know her. I met her. She talked to us. She interacted. She listened. She understood how our family interacts. Hopefully. So I think that's a way of being inclusive. And then the other thing is just being aware of trauma-informed care, right? So I work in eMERGE too. So I think about this sometimes in eMERGE, we have these, you know, tiny little rooms sometimes that we're sticking people in because we've run out of space. And then you like close the door and there's no windows, you know, and that could feel very much like a jail cell where maybe they've been tortured before. So you also need to be aware if there's behaviors that you're seeing or there's a guardedness or the patient is starting to get agitated or angry, it might have to do with some trigger. Like there's something going on in the environment that you haven't thought through, you know, or gynae exams. You need to be very careful. Like I had someone just this week who had wanted an IUD and we started the process of putting the IUD in and it was clear that it was very traumatizing for her. So I said, let's stop. We don't have to do, we can make a different plan today. We don't have to push through just because, you know, I got my next patient to see and I want to be able to chart that we put the IUD in. So you have to kind of come off your own schedule a little bit. And you also, you know, have to realize, like Bola said, there's so many competing demands. Like maybe they're 10 minutes late for their appointment because they got lost on the bus after they dropped their kid off at school for the very first day in Canada, which that would be scary, mm-hmm. right? And so you want to have as much flexibility as you can manage. You know, you don't want to get distressed because if you get distressed because it's too chaotic, they're going to feel that. So you want to be able to put up with as much organized chaos as you can.
Very well put. I wanted to talk a little bit about the inherent power imbalance that exists not only in refugees, but just inherently in the patient-provider relationship. Mm-hmm. So given that refugees may come from situations where they've previously had a lack of power and control, what are some ways that physicians can empower their patients, especially in terms of taking care of their own health and making them feel empowered and respected?
That is a really good question. So some of it goes back to what we've talked about, is asking the patient what they think is going on and asking them what treatments they've had before, because that's also sort of newer in the world of refugee health. We used to think, oh, they haven't had any care when they show up. And more people have had some care. And so it's also respecting the care that they've had and what have they been told. Also being aware that they may have been coming from a system where it was for-profit medicine, right? So we want everyone to have an angiogram because then we can charge for it, right? So sometimes there's a bit of education that needs to go with that piece. Like I'll ask the patient, oh, did you have to pay for that? And then did they want you to pay for the next test? And I'll talk to them a little bit about how in Canada, the setup's a bit different. And I think that knowledge helps them, that you're not just denying them. Because sometimes I think with our public healthcare system, when we say like, oh, we don't MRI all back pains, the patient hears that as like, I'm less than, or I'm a second class citizen, which would be true sometimes in where they've come from. So you really need to explain that this would be the same actually for any Canadian who came in and was complaining of this type of back pain without these red flags. I wouldn't do an MRI, to help them understand that. I remember having an interesting situation quite early on when I was working with Amina, where I think it was with Syrian refugees. And I was asking them, well, what do you think is the cause? And Amina told me, they came out afterwards and asked her in Arabic, is that even a real doctor? She kept asking me what was wrong. So I think we have to recognize that sometimes they've come from a really paternalistic medical system, and that it might throw them off even when I ask them what they think is going on. They may see that as like, she doesn't know anything. I kind of took it as a compliment. Like, I was like, that's good, because I'm leaving them space to speak. And I mean, over time, you know, hopefully they will recognize that I can hopefully provide them with adequate primary care. But I think you do want to be really deliberate about getting their opinion on things. And then you want to ask them what's doable. So let's say it's a newly diagnosed diabetic and you look at the A1C and it is 10.3. So according to the guidelines, you would start them on insulin right away. They would get on a statin, they would get on an ACE, they would get on a da-da-da-da-da-da. So this person is on no medications, didn't even know they had diabetes. It's their first time. So that's when guidelines are guidelines. That's when you sit and you talk to the patient and you say, what do we want to start with? Your sugar's high. Do you have a history? Do you know anybody with diabetes in your family? Try to understand what their context is for it. Talk up through what some different things might be and let the patient choose. Right? Mm-hmm. And then you're going to see them again in a couple months and, you know, or maybe weeks, and you'll make adjustments as need be. But just know that your schedule might not align with their schedule. And so the idea, for example, of going on insulin at their first doctor's appointment could be absolutely overwhelming and terrifying. So calculating in what is the risk here, because you need to think about that too. This is part of your decision-making process as the physician. Is this something where we could start actually just with oral hyperglycemic agents? And talk through a little bit of diet, a little bit of exercise, and then see them again in a month rather than trying to hit all my ticky boxes on my diabetes flow sheet. And sometimes that means I'll chart in the future, consider da 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 da, so that I'm medically legally covered, but also recognize that that's not where the patient's at right now. So I think that's part of practicing inclusive medicine too.
Honestly, I didn't think about a lot of those things, so that's super helpful. So you talked a little bit about how there used to be this notion that refugees didn't receive much medical care back home. So how can physicians ensure a comprehensive transition of care for these patients, given that maybe they've had tests before back home? Because I can imagine that would be tough.
It is. So this is a question that was kind of being asked on a national level, like with there's a group of Canadian Refugee Health Provider Network, and we're sort of asking, how can we measure and do research on transitions in care? How can we smooth this process over? So there's been some really big inroads made, especially University of Calgary has been a leader in this, connecting with IRCC, which is the Immigration Refugee Citizenship Canada. And we've definitely gotten a lot better over the last few years getting documentation of some investigations that have been done before arrival. So we've got a really close relationship with CCLC, Cross-Cultural Learner Center here in London, and we actually are able to see some of the notifications of arrivals for the newly arrived GARs, and that lets us know if someone's coming in on oxygen or with a wheelchair. And then we've, through the work that the University of Calgary has done, made connections with some individual people within IRCC who we've been able to reach out to when we are told, like, there's a patient coming who needs dialysis. So when we had two come this summer, I think, and they usually get dialysis three times a week. So you can imagine, you get dialysis in Jordan, you get on the plane, you get to Toronto, then you get driven to London, you need dialysis pretty fast. Like, we're talking, you know, half a day to a day, maybe. And so we've been able to have some coordination where we're able to get some records, which makes my job a lot easier, because if I phone up the nephrologist at LHSC and I know nothing, and I'm like, hey, someone's coming from Jordan, could I have a dialysis bed tomorrow? That's probably not going to work. But if I'm like, I have a 23-year-old who has glomerular nephritis, who has end-stage renal, GFR is da-da-da-da-da, hemoglobin is 90, he gets dialysis three times a week, his last dialysis session is going to be on Tuesday in Jordan, is there any possibility you could get him in Thursday or Friday? That transition can actually happen. And we've had some times where it's been super smooth. We've had other times where it hasn't been so much. And sometimes that's just the nature of the refugee world, because someone's supposed to be able to get on a plane and then they can't, or something happens, or, you know, so you have to, you have to be able to put up with a certain amount of chaos. But those transitions, those systems are starting. I would say, actually, maybe systems is not the word. The pathways are starting. We're hoping that we can make them into better systems moving into the future. And a lot of this has to do with actually electronic records and privacy and digitization. Because it would be so beautiful if we could just log on and access the IOM, the International Organization of Migration, their doctor's records from when they saw the patient for the physical and history and an exam before arrival. So there's a lot of progress that could be made in this arena. And I think we're just at the cusp of this exciting time. I had one patient who was coming who was a fairly advanced stage of pregnancy, and I was actually able to talk to the obstetrician in Iraq taking care of her. So that was pretty cool. So when those moments happen, you're okay, we might be able to get better at this.
Mm-hmm. So since we're on the cusp, what are some things that we can do to kind of get that started? Because it seems like a huge, huge project.
It is a huge project. I think a lot of it lies with IRCC. And I know this is actually something Mark Miller said to us when we met with him in the fall, that he's got to move them into the 21st century in terms of, I think, the digital part of it. So I think that will be massive. On a local level, the best thing to do is have a tight partnership with your settlement organization. And then University of Calgary hosted this summer a refugee health policy conference, which lots of us who are providers were there, IRCC was there, different settlement organizations were there. And that's the first time that we've all had sort of sit down working groups, policy conferences. It was different than just a refugee health conference. This was much more directed workshops and brainstorming together. And so I think that is hopefully going to turn into a yearly or every 2 years event. And that's where I think a lot of the progress will be made.
Mm-hmm. And how can students in particular get involved? I know there might be some notions out there, for example, volunteering with CCLC, there's a language barrier with a lot of the refugees. So people might feel like, oh, I can't speak Arabic, so I probably won't be of help. So what are some ways that students can help?
Well, I think what you mentioned with CCLC is a great opportunity. So they have family matches. And I know there's been lots of med students in the past who have volunteered with CCLC. And one of the programs, so the family match, they match you with a newly arrived family and you help support them in sort of an informal way. The good thing is now with Google Translate, that can really help with that, with the language barriers. And in reality, learning for both the med student and for the refugee to learn to communicate without an interpreter present is going to actually help you both in the long run, even though it's tricky. But remember too, that in that setting, you're not providing healthcare. So you're not going to harm them by misunderstanding, what they were saying. This is more of a how do we help you feel welcome and integrated? And as the relationship progresses, there's probably more opportunity for health education and that type of thing. And then CCLC does have specific programs sometimes, they'll have a youth program or a children's program. So definitely volunteering through there. And then we talked a little bit about LUSO in the northeast end of the city and the South London Neighborhood Resource Center. So there are settlement services there. And so potentially too, those are other avenues to volunteer in. And the YMCA. So the YMCA does a lot of programming for newcomer youth and newcomer children. I have children who are here without parents who get programming through the YMCA. And then I know we've had different opportunities at times, during COVID, we had med students come in and help us run our COVID vaccine clinics with refugees and refugee claimants. And it was so great. The med students were kind of our logistics people, making sure everybody got to the right spot. And then I think look for opportunities through school, whether there's usually a newcomer club, right? In first and second years, and you guys can organize to have speakers and have events and things like that. And then, when you get chances for electives in your clerkship or in your fourth year too, is can I work with, Dr. Buma who sees refugees, or can I do a rotation with us at the refugee resettlement clinic? And then also go look at how other cities are doing it, because we're all sort of figuring this out, right? And so it's useful to just not think about the way London's doing it, but also a place like Calgary that's got a really tradition of longstanding excellent care for refugees. Look at some of those places too, potentially, to do electives.
Yeah, I think those are all really, really great resources.
Oh, I have one more.
Yeah, go for it.
So there is online CCIRH, there's e-modules, e-learning modules for refugee health created by Dr. Doug Gruner and Dr. Kevin Potty. And there's also access to, through the CMAJ, there are refugee health guidelines that we follow for like screening and what blood tests to do and what sort of infectious diseases should we screen for and what is not worth it. So those are all good resources too to look up. And the e-learning is excellent because it kind of walks you through different cases.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for that. That's super helpful. So just to wrap up, I know we've talked about this in various forms, but what advice do you have for anyone who wants to pursue a career similar to yourself in refugee and global health?
Mm-hmm. One thing that I kind of wish I had told myself when I was in first year was just chill out a little bit and become a really good physician at whatever it is you do. Like whether you end up wanting to do orthopedics or internal medicine or psych or family medicine, learn it well, pick what you feel passionate at, what makes you feel good about the work that you're doing, because there'll be opportunities to do refugee health in whatever, you know, specialty you go into. And then I think, so there's that piece of it, but then do stay connected, because I think what happens too is we go through medical school, we go through residency, we get so tired and life happens, right? Like maybe you meet a partner, maybe you start a family, maybe your parents get sick, or maybe there's, you know, financial hardship that some family members you need to help them out with. So you need to do that. So you are going to have all these competing demands. And I think you just want to keep that competing demand of the marginalized population in front of you. Like you don't want to totally forget about that. Because I think when, at least for me, I'm not sure if it would be the same now, but there was a whole lot of us who wanted to do global health. And then probably, you know, there wasn't quite so many people at the end of residency who were able to focus on that because of some of these competing demands. And that's not wrong. Just everyone's life unfolds differently. So I think you just want to keep somehow a touch point so that you always remember, okay, this is like something I'm passionate about, so that it sort of colors the way you go through your training.
That makes a lot of sense. Is there anything else that you want to mention before we wrap up?
I think that I always find it really exciting that students are passionate about this, because I do think that over the years, we're seeing like a larger and larger group of students who are passionate about refugee health. And I think some of that reflects to the diversity of the medical school. Like when I went to medical school, it wasn't as diverse as it is now. And so I find that really exciting. So I think students shouldn't hesitate to speak up about it, to speak up about like, oh, you know, I think this family is refugees and they might be struggling with this, and this, if they're in a situation where maybe the attending or their preceptor is sort of like dismissive of the experience, or the university is dismissive of the experience, or, you know, like all those kinds of things. So I think you can really be leaders as medical students in recognizing the importance of trauma and violence-informed care, and also cross-cultural humility.
Thank you so much, Dr. Henderson. I know I learned so much from this podcast, and I'm sure the listeners did as well. Again, thank you so much for being here.
No problem. Thanks.
For our last speaker of this series, I'd like to introduce Bola, a nurse practitioner who's been working at the resettlement clinic for almost 6 years. This episode was meant to give listeners real practical advice on how to approach refugee health as a current or future healthcare provider, or anyone interacting with these populations in the community. This includes not only physicians, but the valuable experiences of nurses and nurse practitioners who also contribute significantly to refugee healthcare. Here, Bola outlines several simple tips to help you all, our listeners, when interacting with refugee populations.
So, as a nurse practitioner, what are some of your tips for providing trauma-informed care to refugees?
So, I believe trying to get to know the clients for who they are, meet them at the place where they are at, knowing that they're just coming to a new country and they have a lot of other issues, other social determinants of health that might be affecting their health generally. And just listening here and knowing that there are other factors. So they are thinking about housing, they are thinking about settlement, they are thinking about their employment as well. Some of them want to go back to school. So all of these things is like something that they are really focusing on, and then you trying to help them with their medical needs might not be a priority for them. So it's just important to meet them at the place where they are at and making sure that you are constantly repeating yourself when it comes to instructions, because some of the clients, they might misunderstand what you're trying to say because some of the information might be missed during translation or interpretation. So it's important to explain and try to validate their understanding. So are you telling me that this is what this medication, you take it like this, you take it like that? So you are constantly repeating yourself just so that they understand. Another tip I will want to give is don't make assumption. It's important to ask. Especially at their first visit, they might have a lot of other things that they want to tell you, and they might miss out on some of the information, and later on you might start finding out, oh, they had a surgery. Okay, how come you didn't tell me that at the first visit? Well, because they have other things that it's on their mind, and they might not be able to get to all of that. So it's really, really important. And in terms of nonverbal communication, I always say that everybody understands a smile. You might not be able to understand what they're saying because of the language barrier, but, you know, welcome them with a smile, and then they will feel comfortable because they're already feeling so nervous being in a new country. Being an immigrant myself, I know when I first came to Canada, I was so nervous. I remember when I was at the airport and it was during the winter season, and I saw that the family member that came to pick me up at the airport, he was speaking and I was seeing like smoke coming out of his mouth. And I was like, is he smoking? But I don't even see any cigarette. So it was later on I realized, oh, it's because it's cold. So so something as small as that, they just feel so scared and everything is so foreign to them and they're so nervous. Just try to explain in lay-term language so that they can be able to understand what you're saying. And also get to understand their cultural context as well. Some things might be a red flag if you look at it from a Canadian perspective, but coming from where they're coming from, it's normal for them. It's normal for them. For instance, you might have a 17-year-old telling you that, oh, she's married. And you're like, what? You're 17? How is that possible? But that's a cultural thing for them. And it's so important to keep an open mind and not to be judgmental and accept them for who they are and show them the love that they deserve like everyone else does. And also in terms of the healthcare system, I think it's so important that if you're working in the hospital, you need to try to advocate for our clients, the refugees clients, because they need the interpretation. They need that interpretation for them to be able to receive the best care. We shouldn't just assume that they understand. It's good to get that for them because there are some information that might be missed. In fact, there was one that happened recently. A client was seen in the hospital and they made some changes to the medication, but the medication is actually not appropriate because the client actually had an history of a heart catheterization, but the client was not able to explain that because they didn't use interpretation. So going back to the social determinants of health, as we all know, everything is so expensive. And being a refugee, coming into a new country and being given like just a fixed amount of money per month, sometimes it's not enough. So sometimes these clients are going through a lot of stress. And we know that social determinants of health is a huge factor. So it's so important that we try to address the psychological issues as much as possible by advocating for them. Sometimes I find myself as a nurse practitioner that I do most of that compared to doing more of the medical needs. Because if someone is struggling with paying their rent and you're telling them that their blood pressure is high and you want to give them a, you know, blood pressure medication, but they are constantly thinking about, how am I going to pay my rent? So you know the root issue of the high blood pressure. So it's so important to address the root of the issue.
Thank you so much. It was really helpful. And I'm sure all of our listeners will really appreciate that.
That concludes our episode today and this two-part series on refugee health. We hope you were able to learn something new and become more aware of how increasingly relevant refugee health is becoming for our evolving population. Thank you for listening to the Hashtag Health Podcast. If you want to stay updated on our new episodes, be sure to follow our Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Hashtag Health Podcast.